This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So today is the official start of the holiday shopping season. It's come to be known by the quasi-official name of Black Friday. And apparently that name originated from police officers as a way of describing traffic congestion and the scuffles that come along with masses of people maneuvering to be first in line. And it's a dark name for some sometimes dark behavior, not exactly comfort and joy. But remember, except for maybe during a Harry Potter release, most people don't get into fist fights at local bookstores. We think not only do books make the best gifts, but the process of getting one and giving one is much more civilized. And so with that in mind, today in the program, we bring you our annual holiday book show. And here's how it works. We've gathered the experts from three local bookshops to suggest titles for the gift-giving season. And they have lots of books here with them and long lists, so we probably won't get to everything, but as always, we'll have the complete list available on our website, and we'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. So joining us here in the studio, Ken Sanders, the owner of Ken Sanders Rare Books in downtown Salt Lake City. Ken Sanders, welcome back.
Always a pleasure, Doug.
Catherine Weller is back with us, the new book buyer for Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square in Salt Lake City. And welcome back to you.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
And Betsy Burton back with us. She, of course, co-owns the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th in Salt Lake.
Welcome
back.
Hi,
Doug. Hi. Okay, so again, I don't want to spend too much time on anything but titles, but let me just ask you all, how's it going? What are the books that are selling right now? Do you get a sense and a vibe of what's on people's minds as you look at the books going out your doors?
Well, I think it's going really well. I think, you know, I think I've said before that independent bookstores are sort of in a renaissance, and they still are. People need community in the worst way. I mean, it's what everybody's looking for, so they love coming in. But I think they're also now looking in a different way at books not just to escape into, but books that can patch their world together. Mm. We all feel like our world's disintegrating. Nobody knows which way's up anymore. Mm. And I think books that try to make sense of the world are what people are looking for.
What do you think?
And there was a time when I thought my beloved current affairs and political science sections were dead, that the whole conversation was moving to the blogosphere. And there's nothing like confusing times to make people want to hit pause and take a second to delve a little bit deeper. Hmm. Not everybody, obviously, yeah, but many people. And so we've seen a big resurgence in issues-oriented books. And that doesn't just fall into my choice sections. It also falls into fiction, too. You see, yeah, a lot of fiction, people appreciating fiction for what it can do, which is help people see through a different lens.
Hmm. What do you see, Ken?
Well, Doug, when we're talking about Black Friday, let's not forget about Indie Saturday either, that all of us independent booksellers participate in. I think as along with local authors and a renaissance in new book publishing, we're also seeing a real renaissance in independent publishers, like our own local Torrey House Press in the past 3 years is really coming on strong with a lot of things. And old standbys like Gibbs Smith Publishing and Signature Books are still doing great work. And there's a whole plethora of new independent regional and Utah publishers to go along with all these voices and authors. I think it's a real renaissance time.
Well, I'm guessing you may have a few titles in mind. You want to start?
Let's start with local authors and local books. But with the local theme, we can't get through the show without talking about Pat Bagley, America's longest standing employed political cartoonist in the country.
Is that true?
He has been with the Salt Lake Tribune for over 40 years, and
wow,
they haven't fired him yet. This 40 years with Bagley, the Salt Lake Tribune, is an exclusive publication by Pat that only the King's English, Weller Bookworks, and Ken Sanders Rare Books will be selling for the holiday season. Right. Yay, Pat, go Indies. It's a great book. It has 100 of his best cartoons. By his own estimations, he's drawn over 10,000 1,000 cartoons in his career. I would like to think of this as volume one of the best of Pat.
They are so here. Good.
Yeah. I keep rooting for him for a Pulitzer.
Yeah, he did.
Amen. Pulitzer for Pat Bagley. Yeah. And following in his shadow, a more serious brother, Bagley brother, Will Bagley. This is volume 16 of Kingdom of the West, The Mormons and the American Frontier. It's the final volume in the series. Will Bagley has been writing and editing this series for 22 years.
Wow.
And it's finally over. Volume 16 is appropriately called The Whites Want Everything, Indian-Mormon Relations, 1847 to 1877.
Sounds like a title he would
write. Some things never change.
Will wanted me to point out that it's his at his great cost to him. I don't know where they are, and it doesn't matter because we're on radio. There are 8 colored plates in this volume, the first. It's really a culmination of his entire career, and I don't know anybody else that if a picture's worth 1,000 words, I would posit which Bagley has written the most. Leave it at that.
Or said the most.
And then briefly, Terry Tempest Williams has a brand new book, Essays of Undoing. I believe you're going to interview her. I won't talk a lot about it, except to point out it's one of her best yet. It's one of her most activist books yet in her long and storied career. And I'm so pleased to see a written account, a whole chapter, an interview with Tim DeChristopher, who 10 years ago did BLM protests here in Salt Lake and started a whole social justice, climate change activism that continues to this day. Torrey House Press, the aforementioned Torrey House Press, has issued Craig Child's Virga and Bone, Essays from Dry Places, in this peculiar little small format of that they've seemed to like a lot. I kind of like them a lot. I guess you could put them in your pocket, but being a book collector, I don't actually ever put books in my pocket, but you could, I guess. They wouldn't be very pristine afterwards. They're really, really great essays. Craig Childs just keeps getting better. He's going to come. When he comes, he and Kate McLeod will be at our store January 20th doing a performance from this book.
Wow.
And even I don't know what that means.
But the
two
the
of them.
Say the name again.
Craig Childs, Virga and Bone, Essays from Dry Places.
All right. Betsy Burton.
Okay, well, I did bring Terry Tempest Williams' Erosion as my first book, and because of her, I'm presenting nonfiction first, because usually it is fiction in my life. But I think this is a very important book, and it kind of gets back to what I was talking about at the beginning. We all feel like our worlds are falling apart, and erosion is the theme for that in this book. Erosion in a personal way of her life, erosion of the earth, God knows, inability to stop that erosion because of what's going on, erosion of our democracy, erosion of our Constitution. Everything feels like it's eroding right now. And so into this theater comes Terry, whose life already had eroded in the sense that she had a job that she adored here at the university, and it was a chair that she had gotten endowed, and through a series of things that I won't describe, she ended up no longer having a job. She wasn't let go, but it was impossible for her to stay. And then this year, her brother died, and this was something of personal, just a smashing of her universe. And so everything is gone, and what erosion does, according to Terry, is undoes and then becomes. And this is the hope that is always in Terry Tempest Williams' books. It's just extraordinary. And Ken mentioned one piece of that, and I'm going to mention another one, and that is the hope that's now starting on the ground, grassroots, in San Juan County. And the account of that in this book is just amazing. I think that Terry Tempest Williams is one of our major writers, and this time she has exactly captured the world that we're living in, and I can't recommend it highly enough.
So then, Betsy, say the name of that again.
Erosion. It's Terry Tempest Williams. It comes from For Our Stress. So on a very different note, in nonfiction, The Body by Bill Bryson. Bill Bryson, as we all know, is funny, but this is no Road to Little Dribbling. This is about the human body.
Are you sure?
Well, he's got a section called The Nether Part.
Uh-huh.
So But it is a book about the body, and it isn't, you know, drop-dead funny like many of his books, but it's utterly entertaining because all of these people who made medical discoveries are in here, and some of them were done in by their people who were trying to take credit. Some of the fascinating, entertaining stories. He starts with the head, the brain, the ear. You can't imagine the things the ear does in our bodies. He just covers the gamut, as I said, to the nether parts and beyond to death. And every single chapter is like a chapter in a wonderful novel. You're totally engaged and entranced. You learn more about the body than most of us who don't study medicine will ever know. I think it's a wonderful present for almost anyone. Then my last piece of nonfiction I wanted to talk about, this is again in a very different vein, is The Letters of Cole Porter. Cole Porter, as anyone knows who likes musicals, the great American songbook, you know, from Kiss Me, Kate, to songs like You're the Tops, which I still am trying to remember the lyrics to because they're so complicated, to Night and Day, Can-Can, Silk Stocking, etc. So his letters are as clever and as fun to read or his lyrics are to listen to. In here is everything from professional letters to love letters to funny letters to his friends. It goes on and on. And through all of these letters together, he creates the arc of his life is created. It's like reading a wonderful biography. And I loved every page of it. And I think anybody who loves books of letters or who loves Cole Porter, and those fans are legion, would adore this book. The Letters of Cole Porter. Michael Feinstein said revelatory. Kevin Kline said perfect.
Wow. High praise. Okay. Catherine Weller.
Okay, so my first pick is Underland by Robert McFarlane. People may recognize his name. Betsy, I believe, recommended his book last year, Lost Words, which was a kid's book about words from nature that have been extracted from the OED. He's also done The Old Ways, which was a wonderful book many whiles ago. This one, Underland, is subtitled A Deep Time Journey, and it is all things or many things underground. It covers a lot of different spaces and places, and the part I'm about to read describes the Paris catacombs, only not the Paris catacombs the tourists go to. There's a whole different part that one can access if one knows how. And on the day we first go down into the invisible city, castle clouds mass over the lowlands to the north of our entrance point. Flat fields, square steeple church towers, lines of poplars, red-tiled farms. Lowlands, flatlands. My last sight of the sun is a westerly blaze under rain clouds, partly hidden by a huge cone of earth of obscure function. To the east, the cloud base is low and level. Streamers of rain fall gray on a distant village, and the sun sets behind that earthwork. Later, we push at dusk through a door in a wall marked Interdit d'entrer, slip through a hole in a chain-link fence, scramble down a cutting side to a railway line, and crunch along the tracks towards the brick arch of a tunnel. The cutting banks are tangled with acacia trees and wild clematis. Apartment blocks rise above the cutting on both sides, so tall they seem to lean over the space. Once in the railway tunnel, we keep between the tracks because what little light there is glints on the metal and shows us the way, as the floor lights promise to do in airplanes that fill with smoke. Sounds come from up ahead, and a young woman in a white dress with long blonde hair and a porcelain face emerges from the shadows, walking down the tracks towards us. She doesn't blink or pause, and so we step to the left and right of the tracks and let her walk on. She passes through us in silence without breaking her stride and ghosts off towards where, in the far distance, I can just see the tunnel arch of low light through which we have come, fringed brightly with green. We crunch on. Ahead in the darkness is a flock of fireflies, soft orange lights bobbing in the black air. The fireflies neither advance nor retreat, and their light causes the brickwork of the tunnel to flit and shine. We draw closer, and bodies gradually attach themselves to the lights, and we see they are not fireflies, but devils. For the lights are the twinned barred flames of carbide lamps mounted on the foreheads of people milling around one side of the tunnel. When we are 50 yards from the people with their devil horns of light, I see a woman sit down on the tunnel floor, turn sideways, raise her arms above her head, and join her palms like a diver readying to jump, then disappear feet first into the invisible city. And then he describes the catacombs under the catacombs in Paris. He also talks about experiencing fungus with a worldwide fungus expert in Great Britain, seeing the trails of fungus that interact with the trees, nuclear waste repositories, salt domes. It's absolutely fascinating. It's a wonderful gift. It's a great book to delve into in the cold months, and it is called Underland by Robert McFarlane.
Great. Okay, Betsy Burton, back to you.
Well, now I'm getting to my beloved fiction, and I'm going to stick in the first book to the same theme, Margaret Atwood's The Testaments. And people who I talk to as a bookseller about this say, oh, no, no, I can't take a dystopian novel. Please, please.
Right.
And I'm here to say that this is no dystopian novel. This is its opposite. This is women fighting back, fighting against Gilead. You know, Gilead was meant to subject women to, I mean, they're just childbearers, nothing else. And so as this book starts out, Gilead is now an established state, and one of the young women who is a character is a protester who lives in Canada. One is a young woman who is the daughter of one of the commanders, and one is the enforcer, a woman who enforces all the other women. And secretly, all of these women are plotting the overthrow of Gilead. And it reads like a thriller. You can't put it down. It goes from voice to voice, back and forth. And you're just rooting for these women. And as the plot starts to come together, it starts to make more and more sense. It's just a brilliantly crafted novel. The voices are wonderful. You know these people because you always know Margaret Atwood's character,
right.
Characters. And I absolutely loved it. And it gives you faith, not the opposite, which is good.
Say the name again.
The Testaments. It's Margaret Atwood. Then another book that I just loved and another writer that I just love, Elizabeth Strout. This is Olive again, for those of you who have read Olive Kittredge. This is that Olive, that strong, strong voice that Olive Kittredge had, that kind of unpleasant personality and that heart that actually beats inside, even though people don't think it does. And in this book, she is aging. It's taking her right to old age, and it's doing it in that same way where she just states the obvious like nobody ever does. And it's so effective. And there's a series of stories. She's in all of them. She isn't at the heart of every one of them. But what emerges is the human heart, you know, the things that really get us, whether it's somebody being unfaithful or somebody doing an extraordinary kindness to somebody else. She really gets the human heart. And she is one of our best writers. Simple, kind of like Rick Russo. Humorous, simple, and plain spoken in a way that really gets to everybody. Then, this is a kind of extraordinary novel. It's actually a mystery. It's called Country. It's by Michael Hughes. This is about the Troubles, but it is also a retelling of the Iliad. And it has that extraordinary cadence that the Iliad has, just this powerful, powerful storytelling. And it starts out, some of its sentences start out with this kind of Irish, now let me tell you again, you know, so that you're in the story and somebody's telling it to you as if you were in a room with a fire. And there is Pig, who is Agamemnon. He's really unpleasant and greedy. And there is Henry. There is Achille, who is a marksman, and guess who he is? Mm-hmm. Achilles.
Yeah.
And so it all goes. It reads like a thriller. It is a thriller, and it is an exceptionally brilliant novel. And, you know, it hasn't gotten a lot of play, and it should have. This is just an extraordinary story. So then
title one more time, sorry.
Country.
Yes.
And just briefly, I have about 16 seconds here. Out of Darkness, Shining Light, Bettina Gappa. This is about David Livingston alive, and then the people who work under him, slaves one and all, carrying his body across the continent. The voices are funny sometimes in a Jane Austen-ish way. They're wonderful. And through it all, you see the slave trade, not up close, but everywhere nonetheless. It's just an extraordinary book. Out of Darkness, Shining Light, Bettina Gappa. I guess that's how you say her name.
Great. Betsy, thanks very much. Mm-hmm. Catherine Muller, back to you.
So my first book is called Nothing to See Here by Kevin Wilson. It came onto my radar because it's by Kevin Wilson, who wrote Family Fang. And then I saw the cover image after I had had something to read for a while and thought, how did they get that picture of me? There is a small child in its underwear with flames just coming up from the kid's waist. This is just a wonderful story of a woman named Lillian who took the rap for drug possession in high school for her roommate at a fancy boarding school and was expelled. Years later, her friend calls her and says, "Hey, I have a job for you. Would you come help me out, please?" She goes to her very wealthy friend's house. She's married to a senator who has twins from a previous marriage, and her friend would like her to take care of these twins, who it turns out just spontaneously combust. They just burst into flames when things get really emotional. And it is such a well-done novel. It is so well-crafted. The characters in this novel are lovely and extraordinary. How she bonds with these twins, how she becomes protective of them, how she processes her own lack and betrayal that has happened in her life over and over again. It's quite lovely. There is the twist that needs to happen, and you know it's coming, and the arc is perfect, so it happens, and you're like, oh, yeah. It's a great book. It's a wonderful read, and it's Nothing to See Here by Kevin Wilson. The next one I have is Paul Takes the Form of a Mortal Girl. This is by Andrea Lawler. Think of this as a very, very smutty Tales in the City.
Wow.
Smutty, 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 but extremely well written. It is about a man who is sometimes a woman named Paul Polydorus. Paul can willingly transition from one sex to the other. So he spends time as a man, he spends time as a woman. In both manifestations, he is gay. So he is pretty thoroughly queer. And he does this in pursuit of connection and love. And just meeting and experiencing the next person over and over again. The stories in here of each of the people are wonderful tales. It's really quite wonderful. You just have to be able to get past the very explicit sex. Yeah. If you don't mind that, you're going to love it because it truly is a literary novel, too. Paul Takes the Form of a Mortal Girl.
And I love these one-word blurbs. Tight, deep, hot.
There you go. Smutty, smutty, smutty. And so good. Next, I have Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead by Olga Tokarczuk. This is described as a mystery and can be thought of as a mystery on one level, but it is also a wonderful ode to William Blake. It is the tale of a woman who lives in the forests of Poland taking care of rich people's dachas and translating William Blake. She is as thoroughly immersed into connection with the natural world as Blake is. So when people start turning up dead in the small community in the wintertime, it's very easy for her to conclude that the animals are killing them. And why? It is like Eastern European magical realism.
Wow.
It is extraordinary. This was actually written in 2009. She won the Man Booker either this year or last. She is such a talented writer that we should all know much better, and the translation is exquisite. Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead. And just in case you need something really fun for the holidays or for giving, Hollow Kingdom by Kira Jane Buxton. If you thought that the zombie novel had been done in every possible manifestation, I'm here to tell you you're wrong. This is narrated by a crow who is out to liberate the animals who are locked in the houses of people who have turned into zombies in Seattle.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Wait, Hollow Kingdom. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Terrific.
That's us.
Ken Sanders.
Charles Bowden, Doug, you follow?
Yeah.
Chuck's been dead for 5 years now, but it's not stopping him from coming out with new books. He did a year or so ago The Red Caddy about Edward Abbey. Now he has a new book out that's actually one of his most interesting memoirs yet called Dakota. It's a personal memoir of his own family, his own childhood, and his own ancestors. I've never seen Chuck write about anywhere his own family and himself before. It's a very personal book, and I'm going to read a piece from it. The other book is really one about him. It's called America's Most Alarming Writer. It's got dozens and dozens of essays about him from family members, lovers, ex-wives, and fellow writers, Jim Harrison, Scott Carrier, Luis Uria, Leslie Marmon Silko, and others. It even has a piece of, in here about Chuck by me, America's Most Alarming Writer.
Good title.
I want to read from Dakota. His subtitle is The Return of the Future, and I should add it has a brilliant foreword by Terry Tempest Williams. This is a piece called My Piece of Ground by Charles Bowden. On a bend, I will see it, a piece of ground off to the side. I will know the feel of this place. The leaves stir slowly on the trees. Dry air smells like dust. Birds dart and the trails are made by beasts living free. The stars do not complain. They live, explode, die, and send no messages of regret. Sometimes as the darkness grows, I can hear them. Always a low hum, but I never quite catch the melody. I have never belonged. I've cobbled together a life without a clear idea of a career. Money has been a fuel, not an interest. I've never felt aimless, but often careless. The wind seldom blows at this place, and days are almost always sunny. I've never laid eyes on it, but I know it is there. There's never been a moment's doubt about its existence. The place is as solid as rock in my mind. I have never belonged to a place or movement or belief, but still I look. On a bend, I will see it. I live in a time when nations harden into fossils and humans retreat into memoirs. I have never belonged to my time. For me, there are no nations, and families are a thin skin quickly shed once flight from the prison of home became possible. There are two worlds, the living one moving in the day and night through the grass and forest, cruising the rivers, coursing through the seas, the sky also. And then there's the world of noise, talking money and ideas and patriotism and duties and hundreds of other lies. I am stranded between these two worlds, tugged by the murders and vices of my species and bound by every cell in my body to the stars and dirt and slobbering beasts that live ignored and yet persist.
How many of those does he have?
I was told nine.
Holy man.
I mean, I can attest, Chuck, from staying with him, he got up hours before the birds did. And by breakfast, that man, they made me, in my essay in this book, I claimed that he wrote 50,000 words before breakfast, and they made me change that to a much lower number. But I still believe 50,000 words before. And then he would edit half of them and write 25,000 more. He was an amazing machine of writing.
Say the name once.
Dakota, The Return of the Future, Charles Bowden.
That's Ken Sanders. He owns Ken Sanders Rare Books on 2nd East in Salt Lake City. Also with us, Catherine Weller from Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square, and we have Betsy Burton with us from the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. Let me mention, by the way, a list of the books mentioned in the program. The ones we got to and the ones we didn't are on our website, radiowest.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
With KUER's mobile app, you can listen to our live programming stream, enjoy podcasts like Radio West and Preach, browse local news, and access our 24/7 streams of BBC World Service and classical music. You can also use the new Station Finder tool to locate the KUER radio frequency that's closest to you. And if you have CarPlay in your vehicle, our app is now compatible. The KUER mobile app is available for iPhone and Android wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. It's our annual holiday book show today. We figure books are the best gifts for the season, and so we have our book experts with us with lots of ideas for novels and biographies and mysteries and memoirs, some poetry maybe, who knows? Certainly books for kids. It's one of those shows where you're going to need a pen. We have with us, as always, Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books, Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks, and Betsy Burton of the King's English Bookshop. And we're going to begin. This is round three. Catherine Weller, to you.
All right. My first book is so extraordinary that it went out of stock within weeks of publication at Yale University Press, and they're just going to get it back in stock this week. It is called Lakota America, A New History of Indigenous Power. This author is Icelandic. It's by Pekka Hamalainen, and I don't know how to pronounce all those umlauts. But he is the previous author of Comanche Empire, and he is one hell of a writer. He does his own writing in English. It's not translated, and it is just extraordinary. He describes the Lakota from its roots as an indigenous hunter-gatherer tribe in the late 1600s to a river people in the 1700s, and then evolving yet again into a people that is horse-mounted and fearsome warriors. They evolved, as so many tribes had to evolve, as we, the white people, came into the scene, brought new things, and pushed people out and about. He's such a lovely writer. He has such a great deep feeling for the American West and the conflicts of the West. It is very different, definitely a modern history. He does describe the Battle of Little Bighorn as being a perfect victory that then demanded a perfect retribution. And that's just in the introduction. This is a big, bracing, beautiful book. It is vigorous in its scholarship and yet really easy and enjoyable to read. So it's called Lakota America, by Pekka Hamalainen. Next, I have Rebecca Solnit. I have asserted before, and I did earlier this day, that Rebecca Solnit is one of the greatest essayists of our time. Her latest book is called Whose Story Is This? Old Conflicts, New Chapters. And in this, she delves deeper into the question of representation in story. Who gets to have the point of view? Who gets to have the picture drawn of them in the writing? That choice allocates power right there. And, of course, there are many other wonderful essays in here. She's seminal reading for people who like to understand the shifting culture wars and shifting perspectives. Whose Story Is This? Old Conflicts, New Chapters, by Rebecca Solnit.
Great.
Much lighter, by Caitlin Doty, the author of Smoke Gets in Your Eyes. She is the woman who wants to help us deal better with death in the United States. She has a book called Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs? This book is entirely composed of questions that she received from children while on her book tours.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's things like, will my body sit up or speak on its own after I die? And she writes about that. It is not a book for kids. It is a book for adults, but it is very lovely and humorous. Last, this is thought of as a kid's book in a lot of ways. It's published from a kid's publisher, Scholastic. But Sean Tan's illustrations are really for adults in a lot of ways. And I have this thing about kids' books for adults. Cicada is one of them. Poor Cicada. He is an oppressed salary man. The drawings in here are so evocative of longing and isolation. You see him.
Just make it clear, he's a cicada.
He is a cicada.
Yes.
In a suit with a briefcase.
Yes.
And alone in a cubicle until one day magic happens. It's good for anybody who's suffering a lot of burnout. Cicada by Sean Tan.
Lovely. That's terrific.
The suit must be the secret to where the sound they make comes from.
I thought it was good, the crushing of his soul. But
Ken Sanders, on to you.
Speaking of authors that one can't pronounce their names of, Nadia Tolanikova of the famed activist musical group from Russia, Pussy Riot, has written a new Read and Riot, A Pussy Riot Guide to Activism. I think it's just amazing that people all over the world are coming out in this day and age, like Tim DeChristopher, risking going to prison. Nadja and some of her fellow – Tim went to American prison. Nadja and company went to Russian prison. I don't think they're the same.
No.
Rather than tell you about the book, I just want to read a few of the titles. Rule number one, be a pirate. Rule number two, do it yourself. Three, take back the joy. Four, make your government crap its pants. I censored that. Rule five, commit an art crime. Rule number six, spot an abuse of power. Seven, don't give up easy, resist, organize. Eight, break out from prison. Nine, create alternatives. Rule 10, be a woman. And then it has a W-O parentheses about the W-O and man. Very clever. And I can't say enough about this book or her taking on the powers that be.
Say the title again.
Read and Riot, A Pussy Riot Guide to Activism. In the same vein, reading the introduction and book reviews of Edward Snowden's new book called Permanent Record, of his own account of his own dealings with releasing all those massive NSA files, all I can say about this book is you should read it for yourself. And I'm so scared by it that I'm not sure I want to go. I don't think I can carry this phone around anymore. I don't think I can get near a computer, which actually they would like that because computers don't like me any more than I like them. The things that our government is doing to us, I don't know how we got in this situation and why aren't we tolerant. If you read this book, you'll probably go electronic free. Next is, speaking of poetry, which you were, Doug, our latest poet laureate is Joy Harjo, the first ever Native American poet in this country. So there is hope. Her brand new book is called An American Sunrise, and it's just beautiful poetry from a longstanding, important American poet. And it's important that we've recognized her work as not only a woman, but a Native American mm-hmm. woman. I think this is the path back to empowerment. In a completely different vein, one of my favorite novels in the world, Frankenstein, by Mary Shelley. This is a ancient 1930s illustrated book with fabulous woodcuts by the wordless novelist Lynn Ward. But his style of artwork in these woodcuts is so powerful, and I know we can't see them on the radio. They've just issued a brand new paperback edition of it, and I think it's absolutely beautiful and fascinating. Back to activism, we've got this beautiful two-volume set called What I Stand On, The Collected Essays of Wendell Berry, 1969 to 2017. Wendell has published more than 60 books in the past 50 years, and he's in his mid-80s. He's still going strong from the farm in Kentucky, and I think he's one of the most important writers we have in this country today, and I know I've said that many, many times before.
Ken, thank you very much. Okay, over to you, Betsy Burton.
Okay, I'm going to talk about a book that isn't actually out yet, but it will be out in a week. It's called One Long River of Song. It's by Brian Doyle. Brian Doyle is someone whose fiction we at the King's English have adored for a long time. He writes of nature. He is very imaginative. He's a wonderful writer. He has a great sense of humor and whimsy. And so his novels tend to be just beyond wonderful. He died this past year, and this One Long River of Song is indeed one long river of his writings, short writings. Mm-hmm. He is such a wonderful nature writer that you would think that I would pick a work of nature to write about. He's written a book, a piece about hawks called Rapturous. He's written an ode to nurses. He's written a book about how to name a creek, a nameless creek. He's written a little essay on his communication with the Dalai Lama, in which they bonded over sports. He's written a letter to his dead brother. He gets you in the heart, but he is never mawkish or cloying, ever. He has a wonderful sense of humor. And just because it's Christmas and because I thought we all needed a little cheering up, and because it is a poem, although it doesn't sound like one when I read it, I want everybody to close their eyes and picture their first kiss. And then listen to this. One thing no one informs you of when you get ready to kiss a girl for the first time is where to put your nose. Do you lay it alongside hers like a skipper eases his ship along a dock? Or do you take turns, alternating left and right? You laugh, but this is a pressing question, as you well remember yourself. And your hands, do they quest? Or do they alight on her shoulders like birds, like leaves? The glasses on each of your noses, is it sweet when they clink, or is that dorkish? Should you take them off just before you kiss, or is that too confident that you will be kissing? And most of all, the breathing. This is a real problem. Do you hold your breath? Do you aim for staggered breaths, like in a pool? And who is in charge? If your partner wants to retire, what are the accepted signal flags for such a decision? Can I appeal? I hear you laughing, but you were in the same boat. We were shaking. We so wanted to do this well, and so wanted not to be seen to want to. In a sense, it was practice for so very many things that we would want, but would not know how to get, or know what to do with after we got them. You know full well what I mean. Nothing was as gently sweet. Nothing so roaringly nerve-wracking. How could both things be true at once? How could that be? Yet it was so, and would be hourly more so. First kiss. Mm. He is truly a wonderful writer, and these are truly short and easy pieces, and they are all over the map. I think this, of all the books that I know of at the King's English this year, is kind of the perfect present for absolutely everybody. I can't think of anybody who wouldn't love it. So One Long River of Song, Brian Doyle.
We're on to children's books now, and we're going to start with Catherine.
Hey, I've just got a couple of picture books to talk about. The first one is by Brendan Wenzel, who wrote They All Saw a Cat a couple of years ago. It was about perception. Huh? This is called A Stone Sat Still, and it, again, is about perception. It is about the feel of things and the textures of things. And this is about a stone, perhaps, and the various animals that encounter it and how they encounter it. It's a lovely, quiet book. A riotous book, riotous in color, is The Lost Cousins by B.B. Cronin, who did a book we were nuts about a few years ago called The Lost House. It's a seek and find, and B.B. Cronin uses the same palette in here, only instead of color per page, B.B. Cronin uses all of the colors on the palette, so it is vibrant and pops out of the page. This time we're helping grandpa find cousins in various locations. And again, it is really subtle and hard to do. It's called Lost Cousins by B.B. Cronin. My last one is Avalon Nuovo's book, Orchestra. It is
beautiful.
About an orchestra. And yes, it is beautiful. It's very retro in its design. It's retro in its palette. But it is not dumb at all. Although it's for kids, adults can learn from it too. And it is a marvelous tour through an orchestra. The instruments, the structure, all things orchestra in here. You learn about how a piano works, what a saxophone is, how singers are arranged on the stage. It's pretty cool. If you're one of those grandparents that buy season tickets to the symphony, I think this book maybe should be in your bag.
Perfect. Okay, Betsy.
Okay, my first book is a Christmas book. It's called The Great Santa Stakeout. And Freddie is a Santa fan. He even dresses up at Santa at Halloween and Valentine's Day. He has posters of Santa. Everything is about Santa. And the one thing he doesn't have is a selfie with Santa. So he devises a plan, and you can see on the end papers of this great book what the plan is. It's cans on the roof, it's Christmas cookies, it's a trick camera, it's everything he can think of, the most important of which is not to fall asleep. But guess what? Freddy falls asleep. Santa comes, crash, bang, boom, his plan goes awry, he doesn't get the selfie. But who could have had a better Christmas Eve than Freddy, who is playing hide-and-seek with Santa? It's just great. Okay, Just Because is one of those goodnight books, and a little girl is in bed, and her father is trying to put her to bed, and she says, "Why is the ocean blue?" And he says, "Every night when you go to sleep, the fish take out guitars. They sing sad songs and cry blue tears." And so on and so forth through the whole book. She asks him question after question, and finally, Dad is getting a little fed up with all of this. And he says, "You know, it really is time for bed." And she says to him, "Why do we have to sleep?" And he says to her, "Because there are some things we can only see with our eyes closed." It kind of is the perfect one of these books. Then in just a few seconds, Ruta Sepetys, The Fountains of Silence, is set in Madrid. It's 412 and over. The mother of this photographer, young teenager who's a photographer, is from Spain. There is this deep secret in Madrid that adoptions people are using to really traffic babies. So that's kind of the secret around which the plot turns. It's brilliantly written, and it's wonderful for anyone from 12 to 90. I just loved it. The Fountains of Silence, Ruta Sepetys.
Right.
Sepetys, I think is how you say it.
Okay. Ken Sanders.
Well, Doug, I'm not going to leave this political activism.
Go, Ken.
You're sticking to it.
So
all right.
We're taking it to the children's level. Greta Thunberg is the now world-famous Swedish climate activist that began a Friday sit out at her school and going to the legislature in Sweden, and it's now a global movement all around the world. She's been touring our country, did a fabulous speech to the United Nations. These books aren't by her, but they're about her and her cause. The first is called Our House is on Fire by Jeanette Winter, and it's for younger children, and it's a great picture book that really encapsulate what her philosophy has become and tells her story very simply. Can you hear us?
Great. Say the name of that again.
Our House is on Fire, Greta Thunberg's Call to Save the Planet by Jeanette, written and illustrated by Jeanette Winter. This is for older children. We are all Greta. This one, Be Inspired to Save the World, Become a Climate Activist. Valentina Ginaella, and illustrated by Manuela Marisi.
I have to say, these books will be on our website for all of the butchering of names we've done.
I apologize.
There were some
I can't even speak the English language, Doug. Little old Hollies.
I couldn't do it either. Keep going.
This is for much older children and for adults, too. It tells her story in much deeper. It really gets into the issues of climate change and the fact that one young person, a now 16-year-old, a girl, a young woman, whatever you wish to call her, I call her my hero. Fabulous, fabulous books. Can't say enough about them. And lastly, for something completely different, Gumby. Gumby reimagined. If you've got a heart, then Gumby's a part of you. The first coffee table book on Gumby. Who knew?
That is completely different. Okay, we have time for, I'm not even sure we have time, but let's go for a minute and this is what we call our lightning round.
Okay. Treasured Lands, a photographic odyssey through America's national parks. It's gorgeous. Give this to your spouse with a trip through the national parks.
Necronom nom nom. Recipes and rites from the lore of H.P. Lovecraft. It's a cookbook.
Ken. Labyrinth of the Spirits by Carlo Ruiz Zafón. It's his fourth installment in his Cemetery of Forgotten Books series.
Betsy.
Okay. A Book of Gutsy Women. Greta's in this. Hillary Rodham Clinton and Chelsea Clinton. It's the perfect book for any mother to give their mother, any granddaughter to give their grandma, you name it.
Great. Got it.
The White Man's Guide to White Male Writers of the Western Canon by Dana Schwartz.
Ken.
The Selected Letters of Juanita Brooks, edited by Craig Smith.
Okay, Beautiful Machines. I would never have done this, but I love the movie Ford versus whatever it is, Lamborghini or something.
I think cars were your thing, but all right.
They are. Yeah. But I have a new appreciation. This is a gorgeous book of cars.
Great.
Ye Olde Cat Memes, the original book of cat humor. This really is humor.
And Ken, finally.
Ken Babbs, Merry Prankster, co-creator, We Were Arrested by Ken Babbs.
Ken Sanders owns Ken Sanders Rare Books in Salt Lake City. Betsy Burton, co-owner of the King's English Bookshop, also in Salt Lake. Catherine Weller, Weller Bookworks, Trolley Square. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful holiday weekend. A list of these books, the ones we got to and the ones we didn't, are available on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. As always, we want to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Thanks to our intern, Natu Tway, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Ale Vallarta, and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.